The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you're just getting back again from speaking at a conference, and I know that one of the topics at this conference, a chief topic, was deflation. What happens to gold in a deflation? Because I know there's an awful lot of information out there that may be erroneous that says that actually gold goes down like a commodity in a deflation. But is that true?
Well, let's look at that, Kevin, because one of the things that we have to take into account is the possibility of deflation in light of the vast stocks of debt that are outstanding.
Sure.
And this is, I think, one of the misnomers that many people have had, and I'm talking specifically about policymakers, that we can continue to expand the levels of debt we have in light of growth in the underlying economy. In other words, to the extent that the economy continues to grow and grow exponentially, we can support, in a parallel track, an exponentially growing debt base as well. Not a problem. That's where the analysis fails, however, because we do have a problem. The problem is that growth is no longer exponential.
Okay,
it's either stagnant or declining.
Okay, but David, if we cannot sustain that growth, if we can't continue to borrow, if we're actually having to unwind that debt, spending's going to decrease. Shouldn't prices drop?
Well, and you would expect to see that. I think you will see that. That's certainly one of the components, one of the concerns that the deflationists would have is a drop in prices of all assets across the board in light of this debt and deflation or deleveraging unwind. Here's an issue that I think is worth looking at. We have Hungary, which was just downgraded to triple B. So there's trouble, which is now brewing in Eastern Europe. We've got Western European concerns, and we've talked about that ad nauseum over the last several months. Greece has a new prime minister. Italy has a new prime minister. How many things are changing now in the political sphere? And the market wants to think positively about these changes, but it doesn't really have anything to base it on. And I hope that they don't experience the same sort of empty promise that the United States experienced in the last 3 years, where the promise of change was there. But in the last election, Kevin, there was nothing articulated with real specificity. There was no plan. There was no action points. There was no, here's what I'm promising.
Just the words hope and the words change. You know, I mean, things that people, how can you disagree with change or disagree with hope?
And I think that's really what you have is sort of a vacuous expectation in Europe that the new guys will somehow be different and better than the old guys, although those new guys have yet to even propose anything in terms of new and actual plans to be implemented. So we have new leadership in Greece, new leadership in Italy. Kevin, just like we were talking about Hungary and there being stress and strain in their debt markets, of course we've seen French yields moving higher so that the French bond market is under pressure. The Italian bond market has been under extreme pressure.
Well, you haven't even mentioned Spain yet.
Spain is probably in a sequence important, but right after Italy, because the real stress and strain is in Italy today. Kevin, it was interesting, last week we watched liquidity evaporate from the bond markets, and I hope that this is not where analysts on both sides of the ponds are missing the point.
You're talking about European bond markets.
Yes, but analysts on both sides of the pond can say, you see, this is exactly what we're talking about. We have a liquidity issue, and that's why the ECB needs to step in.
Right.
Well, in fact, the ECB did step in, and specifically, Kevin, the two-year Italian bond was trading at a bid-ask spread of 44 basis points.
Okay, so almost half a percent, 44 basis points.
Was the difference between bid and ask, which is enormous in the bond market.
Right.
What that implies is there's no liquidity. In fact, people were just stepping away from the market. So yes, the ECB stepped in and created that liquidity, being the backstop, being the purchaser of those bonds. But the temptation, Kevin, is to look at Europe and to look at the US and say, this is what we're talking about. This illustrates the point that truly central bankers need to make liquidity available because these are liquidity issues. Full stop. What that neglects, Kevin, is that this is not a liquidity issue in the first place. As we've said before, this is a solvency issue, and it's based on the fact that governments have built up a total stock of debt which they can no longer make payments on.
So let me ask you, is this too big to bail out? I mean, is there enough meat in the ECB at this point to bail them out?
Not a chance. Not with Italy. You're talking about $2.6 trillion in debt, and the ECB intervention is essentially allowing banks to exit the Italian bond market. When governments prop up the market, Kevin, they often forget the smart operators are taking advantage of that occasion to get liquid and get out of the market.
See, that's the point. We keep hearing how the bailout, and we saw this in the United States as well. Oh, you need to have a bailout so that the public is saved. But in reality, the banks were saved. Isn't that happening in Europe at this point, too? The banks are the ones who are being bailed out.
Well, yes, and then bring it back home, Kevin. Operation Twist is easing long bondholders' concerns of moving prices lower through liquidation by essentially creating a support structure for prices.
Right.
In other words, Kevin, you're saying I'll write a check for any amount of bonds on the long end of the curve. If it's a long bond, I'm a buyer. Well, guess what? You just may have 10 new people who get in queue to sell who hadn't thought of selling before because they weren't sure what the process was going to be. Could they drive the price lower? Could there be too much discovery, price discovery, on the downside in the context of trying to liquidate a huge long bond portfolio?
So if you're a sophisticated investor or a bank, you know, or big brokerage firm, and you need to get out of some garbage like we saw back in 2008, 2009 here in America, that junk gets sold right there to the largest buying party, which at this point is the ECB.
Well, and garbage is one thing, Kevin, but this is changing sort of the yield structure in the marketplace where you're seeing long bonds, particularly here in the U.S., get shoveled onto the Fed balance sheet.
Right.
And what that's allowing is for heavily exposed investors to quietly take advantage of this, again, without price movements leading to discovery of their mass liquidations. Our view, Kevin, is that the bond markets are growing more unstable by the day, and you see these long positions, people who own the bonds outright, they're liquidating inventories, and those inventories are building on central bank balance sheets the world over. So the Fed is doing their part. You've got the Bank of England who's doing their part to do the very same thing. You've got the ECB who is doing the very same thing. With many of these investors who are now exiting the bond market or limiting or changing their exposure from the long end of the curve to more medium or short-term bonds, Kevin, these are investors who don't intend on returning to that market anytime soon.
So, David, like you've talked about over the last couple of months, people are focusing mainly on liquidity right now. They're forgetting the solvency issue, and that's happening in Europe as well, is it not?
Yeah, with solvency being a consequence of illiquidity. You know, but that's the issue, Kevin. The primary issue is, in fact, solvency. You've got too much debt. That's the problem. And the expansion of debt, it is realistic, and it's manageable as long as growth in the economy is robust and matches it.
Right.
When growth slows or goes negative, the new debt cannot be carried. And, Kevin, that's where we've had this underlying assumption of exponential growth and its corollary. It was supported, exponential debt expansion. In theory, there are limitations to growth, and now we're experiencing that in real time.
Well, okay, that brings me to the point of, you know, we keep saying, all right, on the one hand, are we going to have a European Union? Is it going to hold together? On the other hand, are we going to see this thing dramatically shift or even fail? I mean, is there a problem with the ending of the European Union? We've just sort of grown to assume that it's there, but it's obviously not able to pay its bills.
It's not able to pay its bills, but they may finagle a way out. You know,
okay.
And this would be via greater fiscal integration, greater political integration. I frankly lack the imagination to see that happening. That doesn't mean that it can't happen, but I don't know how that happens. In the context of crisis, usually people are not more open-minded. They're more closed-minded, more insular, and more focused on their national interests and don't generally think about what it takes to integrate further. So I guess maybe I'm drawing on the period of deglobalization circa 1914,
right,
wherein you saw greater conflict between countries, not greater integration, on the heels of 50 to 60 years of greater integration, greater cooperative trade, greater movement of goods and services cross-border and whatnot, and greater currency integration.
Well,
that all came to an end in 1914.
And that's what I was going to bring up. Until 1914, we really did have a global standard, in a way, in the gold standard. There was an equal weight and ratio type of gold standard. But by 1918, you had currencies and countries that were in debt that they knew they couldn't pay. You had World War One just coming to a close, and you had, at that point, a fracturing of currencies with fracturing of values. No longer were they redeemable in gold.
Well, Kevin, another change happened in 1918. 4 years later, the Austro-Hungarian currency union fell to pieces. And so following the war, the redenomination to old currencies was put in motion, and essentially they were placing a unique stamp on the old bills of the Austro-Hungarian currency to reflect which country's monetary system it would now be a part of.
This one is good, this one is bad.
Yeah, so I mean, if we were doing that today, maybe Greece would get a black spot.
Right.
How do you know it's a Greek euro? Oh, it's got a black spot on it. No, but Kevin, what that caused overnight when you were taking apart the Austro-Hungarian currency union was boxcar loads of paper currency fled cross-border to be restamped in the currency of the preferred countries or the more stable countries. And I think one of the things that's important here to remember is if any country, whether it's Italy or Greece or any other, were to leave the union, you wouldn't need boxcars to move the money. It would take a mouse, literally the click of a mouse, to move an elephantine amount of money from one jurisdiction to another. You've got depositor behavior, which consistently leads this change, Kevin, where they say, okay, I see it coming. I think if we leave, there's going to be a devaluation of the drachma. There's going to be a devaluation of the lira. That's how we're going to pay our $2.6 trillion in debt. And guess what? Smart investors are already out of the banking system before it happens. The not-so-smart investors are the ones that end up standing in line outside the bank, and you see essentially a run on the banks or a collapse in the banking system. Today, you don't need to queue. You can literally, again, with a mouse, move an elephantine amount of money.
So if you're a smart Italian, you were out long ago. If you were a Greek, you probably were out last year.
Kevin, that's exactly right. I mean, we have smart Italians who've already made that move, Greeks many months or even years ago, who said, we just aren't going to take any chances here. If they do come out, we know that it's going to be a collapse in the banking system. And that's one of the things that they have to come to terms with, is even though pragmatically they can now pay their debts, what does the economy look like and how do you function without a healthy banking system? Because now you have no trust whatsoever in the banking system and particularly in the underlying currency.
David, with some of the people that we've interviewed in the past, we've seen that protectionism and controls come in when certain types of emergencies like that happen. I mean, boxcars moving from country to country, that may be a 1918 effect, but also they would put any law that they needed to into place to keep those capital flows from coming in or out of the country, right?
Well, that's right. And I think capital controls are something that we've explored a bit in past years. And we've done that because we think that we will see more and more of that in the future in order to get your arms or any central banker's arms around the money system as it is or will be under stress and strain. All that to say, Kevin, you look at Europe, you look at the debt burdens there, you look at our debt burdens here in the United States, and they're unsustainable. Growth, contrary to third quarter GDP statistics, which show U.S. GDP growth at 2.5%, we continue to challenge the notion that GDP is growing at all by asking this simple question. If government deficit spending is equivalent to 10% of GDP today, and it's contributing to the total GDP number that amount, do we have positive growth, or are we actually talking about a situation where we are technically on life support and GDP is underneath the old numbers by 6 to 8%? Growth is irrelevant. Growth is absolutely irrelevant when you have government deficit spending propping up aggregate demand.
Okay, David, I think we all agree that this is unpayable. It's unpayable in Europe. It's unpayable here in America. A lot of the focus has been on Europe because of what's going on there. But really, we're in worse shape than Greece, we've talked about before. Now, you've looked at three different avenues that could be a solution that the government may chase after. I mean, they may chase after the poor, they may chase after the rich, the middle class. Who pays the bill?
Well, and that's why when we, several years ago, 4 years ago, laid out the idea that the crisis, which began as a financial crisis impacting individual financial institutions, as that rolled over into affecting the larger economy, we would eventually see a political crisis on the heels of the economic crisis. And after a political crisis, there was a high probability of even a geopolitical crisis. Now, let's fast forward, because we've already seen the financial, we've seen the economic. Now, frankly, Kevin, we're smack dab in the middle of a political crisis, even though it appears that the economic is with us. It is with us. But now, it's time for politicians to choose who the winners and losers will be, and that is exactly what's happening. The question is, will it be the poor, will it be the middle class, or will it be the rich? The poor will pay the price if we maintain high levels of unemployment and eventually see wage competitiveness re-enter the marketplace. So somebody who is used to being paid $20 an hour has to get used to being paid $10. That is the one option in terms of seeing a correction in the economy.
David, does that really politically fly? I mean, I went down to the Occupy Wall Street movement last week before it was broken up, and I talked to a lot of the people. I asked, why are you here? What would you like to see happen? Now, there were not that many intelligent conversations, but I will say this. They were against the rich. They were against what they think capitalism is. And they're very, very proud that they finally came out with something that they could hand out called the Declaration of the Occupation of New York City. And basically, in the preface, it says, I lost my job, but I found an occupation. And they're doing the play on words with Occupy Wall Street. Now, the poor, can this be solved by the poor just taking lower and lower wages?
Kevin, I don't think it can, because it creates political instability.
Politicians can't get reelected.
That, particularly when you're in a democracy. I mean, frankly, it doesn't matter how many people you have unemployed as long as you're in a command economy. Because if you don't like the people's behavior, you just take them out back and shoot them. You get the point. If you're in Russia and you're unemployed and you're unhappy, the government doesn't necessarily agree with you being able to express your unhappiness, so they send you to the gulag. There, so you are in Siberia.
You get to occupy Siberia.
Yeah, you get to occupy space where no one cares. But that's the privilege, and I'm not suggesting that this is a good thing. This is a terrible thing, but that's what happens in a command economy. In a democracy, when the poor are unhappy, they do have a voice, and that creates political instability. For the powers that be, they look and say, wait a minute, my legacy could be upended in one day with just these people showing up at the polls.
Well, and that puts the second category in right in the gun sight, because the rich, this is one of the messages of Occupy Wall Street, and actually what you're seeing on the press right now is, well, all we need to really do is just tax the rich.
Well, and that may be a solution, Kevin, and I think it may be partially a solution. Certainly we have room to wiggle in terms of increasing tax rates here in the United States. When you look at what the average company, particularly multinational, pays as a percentage of their income, it is a little disturbing to see companies like General Electric actually get a tax rebate and pay nothing on the billions and billions of dollars that they make. That, I have to scratch my head as a small business owner and say, wait a minute, an all-in number for me is close to 50%. You know, the stated is 35, but by the time you add in all the ancillary taxes, I'm at 50. How can I get to zero?
Well, David, and that's so not capitalism. That's cronyism. I knew General Electric, and you're no General Electric.
Well, and I think there is a reason for the folks at Occupy Wall Street to feel like fairness is not there in the marketplace.
Right.
But I think the assessment that this is capitalism that has bred a lack of fairness, Kevin, that's patently absurd. That is not capitalism that is creating the disparity between rich and poor. That is a consequence of central bank policies, which is creating an inflation of asset values. Take for one example, Kevin, the difference between the average household over the age of 65 versus the average household under the age of 35.
Right.
The average household over the age of 65 now has 47 times the balance sheet that someone under the age of 35 has. And just in 2005, it was a 10-to-1 difference. Now it's a 47-to-1 difference. What I'm suggesting is that debt continues to be a burden for anyone who carries it. And for anyone who has assets, those assets are being exploded to higher values on the basis of central bank policies, which are inflating the money system and to some degree repricing assets at higher levels. So this disparity between rich and poor, is it a result of capitalism? This recent study, moving from, again, 2005 numbers of 10-to-1 to present numbers of 47-to-1, it has nothing to do with the rich getting
richer. It has to do with debt.
It has to do with the debt being a burden for those who still carry it, and the average person over the age of 65 has already paid most of their debts. But that's not to say that these people are particularly wealthy. The average net worth of the person over 65 is $170,000, and that's reflective of owning a home as well. So say the average home is $150,000. You're talking about someone who has free cash in the bank or in an investment account of not more than $20,000.
Okay.
Kevin, this is not the rich and the poor. We're just talking about debt continuing to be a burden while assets, to some degree or another, get the inflation benefit from the Fed.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. So, David, you're a politician at this point, and you're tapping a maple tree, the rich. Do you solve the problem?
You can solve a PR problem by tapping the rich, and you can convince the poor that you're being aggressive, and that's one of the reasons why I think they will increase taxes to some degree.
Right.
But they will lose if they say, okay, well, let's just move taxes to 100% on the rich.
Right.
Kevin, that'll create a couple $100 billion more, which doesn't even begin to take care of 1 year's new spending deficit, let alone chip away at the interest and principal that we have to pay on the outstanding stock of debt.
Okay, so you're not going to get the solution by the poor taking lower wages. You're not going to get the full solution by tapping the rich. All that leaves is the middle class.
It leaves the middle class, Kevin. And this is the classic case of adjustment. You look over time, and the place that you adjust for imbalances on your balance sheet, if you have control of a printing press, is via the printing press and paying off that debt with cheaper and cheaper dollars. And the reason why the middle class come into the crosshairs is because they're the ones who are most influenced by this activity.
So, David, the rich, they have assets. The poor, they don't have assets. The middle class, they have debt, a mix of debt and assets.
But the problem is most of their assets are associated with their debt.
Yeah.
And so for the average middle class person, they have two assets. One, their home, which I would consider a liability. An albatross, not an asset, because it doesn't create anything other than warm fuzzies and happy memories, which is very important, but from a financial perspective, it's not an asset. It may be for your family an asset, but don't misconstrue it as something that's going to either be adding cash flow or be a growth asset over time. I think, Kevin, what you have with the middle class, the only other asset they typically have is a 401k. And we've looked at the statistics on that. They end up being very, very, very small. So, you know, essentially, the middle class, what savings they have, they see their savings eroded in the context of taking this adjustment via the currency. The middle class, they lack one thing, a real understanding of what inflation is.
Right.
And I think this is where, Kevin, the government that we have, as well as the government that we see in Europe, the government that we see in Great Britain, the government that we see, just universalize
Zimbabwe.
This. Zimbabwe. They yeah. realize that this is a way out. This is a way that very few people will appreciate what's happening to them as it's happening to them, and if things get out of control, you can always blame your neighbor.
Right.
This is where the crisis can morph from a political choice for the middle class to take the hit, not knowing that they've been chosen. But if things get out of control, politicians still reserve the right to blame someone else. Blame the Chinese, blame the Japanese, blame the Mexicans, blame the Canadians, blame the Europeans, blame the Spanish. In fact, you know what we might find? We might find the government, if the current administration is reelected, blaming Israel.
Yeah.
Why? Because if Israel does go after Iran and we see the price of oil back at $150 a barrel, they'll have the perfect cover because they can inflate the holy heck out of the money system. Meanwhile, the thing which is sort of the hallmark for inflation the world over, higher energy prices and higher oil prices, will communicate to the rest of the world that it's not monetary policy and it's not bankers, but in fact it's the energy market, and if Israel hadn't done this, we wouldn't be in this problem today. All I'm saying, Kevin, is it doesn't matter who you blame, but this crisis will move from the current place we're at today, a political crisis where you're choosing the winners and losers, and I think it's going to be the middle class taking the adjustment via currency devaluation, to a geopolitical crisis where someone is blamed because ultimately inflation gets out of control. We saw this in the 1970s as inflation rates move from 2% to 4 to 8 to 16. It moves on an exponential basis. What begins a very tame and controlled process eventually explodes out of control.
Well, then that brings up the question of interest rates, Dave, because, you know, if we do actually have inflation, people need at some point a positive rate of return. Okay, now I think we've looked at the numbers and $185 billion of our deficit right now is in interest payments. Okay. But if we inflate, interest rates have to rise. We have to pay people more to buy our bonds and to take on our debt. What happens when interest rates go up to our debt?
Well, even without an increase in interest rates, the Obama administration has suggested that by 2015, the interest component for our national debt here in the United States will go from $185 to $554 billion on the basis of an increased total stock of debt. So we're moving from $185 to $554.
That's assuming real low interest rates where we're at now.
Right. Yeah, so it's only predicated on an expanded base of debt. Now, with an increase in interest rates, I think we could find ourselves, Kevin, in the next 5 years with interest payments alone totaling more than $1 trillion a year, which means, Kevin, that that's just for perspective. The tax revenues to the federal government total $2 trillion a year.
Okay, so half of your tax dollars
would go to be paying the interest only. This is a problem, Kevin, that over the next 3 to 4 years is going to be a nightmare. And it's one of the reasons why political expediency today and going the monetary route and trying to inflate our way out of a debt spiral could cause major international geopolitical conflict, because at the end of the day, those same politicians and central bankers will not own the decision that they made. They will not accept the mistakes that they've made as their own, and they will have to point the finger and say, listen, if the Chinese hadn't been manipulating their currency, we wouldn't be in this position.
Sure, you always blame somebody.
It could be anyone, on any basis. I mean, I don't know how you blame the Canadians. I don't think they can do any harm, but they will find a problem, and they will find someone to point the finger at.
Okay, now, David, we started this conversation with deflation, and we really didn't fully answer that question. But now we've moved to inflation, and people listening to this program know that we recommend at least a third in gold. Now, we've heard people say, well, gold goes down in a deflation. Make sure that you just hold out for it. Most people agree that gold does go up in an inflation. I mean, it's pretty obvious when the dollar devalues and gold holds its value, it's going to go up. But Would you address, please, the deflation argument? Because I think there's a misinterpretation there, and I have no idea historically where people come up with this.
Well, let's first kind of define our terms. If inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, then deflation is too little money chasing too many goods. That's
right.
Probably the easiest way of kind of contrasting them.
Okay.
And what we're really talking about is the available money and credit in the system. And if there's more money and credit in the system than the currency and credit in the system, then you're leaning in the direction of inflation. And if you really lean, it's because there's been a massive amount of printing or credit created. Kevin, the exact opposite with deflation, and the concern there is that you'll see people selling all assets in order to raise cash. Here's the issue, Kevin. Yes, saving and hoarding replace spending in a deflation. That's very true.
Right.
But people tend to save the best credits. This is a critical concept because when you're saving the best credits, you have to take into account who stands behind the paper or the asset that you desire to own. Now, if you're talking about the British pound, if you're talking about the US dollar, if you're talking about the euro, if you're talking about the Japanese yen, you're talking about putting faith in a certain number of PhDs who are quote-unquote managing the system.
And it's all fiat. It's not backed by anything.
Correct. And in fact, if you price any of those currencies in gold, you see devaluation run amok. Management is too generous. Mismanagement, unless this is exactly their intended course to bring these currencies lower, then they may be. Then they may be on track for succeeding. This is the point again. People tend to save the best credits. And that best describes gold. Gold is nobody's liability. When liabilities are being liquidated in the context of a deleveraging or deflation, the importance of counterparty exposure is brought into relief. And so you have to ask yourself the question, who stands behind this?
Right.
Whether it's a greenback, a treasury bill, or an oat, which is the Italian bond. I don't know why they call it that. But gold, Kevin, as money gains popularity in deflations, particularly in the case of coincident monetary crisis. And I think this is what people forget, that gold has been conveniently relegated to the category of commodities.
Right.
But that is a concept which is only about 3 decades old.
Yeah, gold was money until then. And then Nixon, actually, 3 decades. It's been about 4, hasn't it?
Okay,
I mean, 1971, let's face it.
So now we have central bankers the world over, money managers the world over, and the general public the world over, who tends to see the dollar, the yen, the euro, the British pound as money. But Kevin, in a real deflation, in a real deleveraging, you go to the best credit, and the beauty of gold is that it is no one's liability, and you don't even have to consider counterparty. That's not in the equation at all. If you go back to Roy Jastrom's book, The Golden Constant, Kevin, he looked at 5 periods of deflation between 1600 and 1971 that lasted, and we're not talking about sort of a 3-month snap or a 6-month snap. These periods of deflation lasted anywhere from 11 to 38 years, okay? And in every instance, the purchasing power of gold increased between 42% to 82%.
In every instance. So every instance of deflation, extended deflation, gold rose, not fell.
I could care less. I could care less about the nominal price of gold. Again, I don't care about the nominal price of gold. Never have, never will. I care about what an ounce of gold translates into
in
terms of some other form of value.
Right.
Whether that's acres of farmland, whether that's shares of Illinois Tool Works, whether that's, I mean, just tell me what I'm translating it into, because I don't have confidence in the Fed, and I don't have confidence in their fiat money. So why would I value my stuff against their fiat? I'm going to value my stuff against other real stuff. Again, those are 5 periods of deflation where the purchasing power of gold was on the increase. This is what's kind of different than the modern conception of gold being an inflation hedge, because Jastrom looked at 7 periods of inflation in the same time span where the purchasing power of gold went down even as the nominal price went up double digits.
Right.
And again, you're talking about purchasing power, purchasing power, purchasing power. When you're in a period of nominal inflation, low inflation, 2, 3, 4%, gold doesn't do a bit of good in your portfolio. It does well during radical inflations.
Right.
It does well on a major price adjustment basis when the world recognizes that an inflation has occurred. A major inflation has occurred, you get a repricing, and it's sort of a one-off event. But to assume that on a daily basis, you know, let's say the CPI comes out and it's a low number as of tomorrow.
Right.
And gold sells off because we don't have inflation. wrong way to look at it.
That's short-term perception anyway.
Exactly. So people don't buy gold, frankly, Kevin, to protect from inflation as much as they do to remove certain portfolio risk. And that's what we're talking about, being in a real rate of return environment. You're just stepping outside the market.
Okay, David, I'd like you to go through those four periods of time that Jastrom looks at, but I do want to mention there is an exception, 1920 to 1933. Gold actually did better than what you had talked about in the previous periods.
Yeah, so if the average, Kevin, was 42 to 80% in terms of an increase in purchasing power, the period between 1920 and 1933 stood out because you saw general price declines across basically all asset classes, an average about 69%. And gold's increased purchasing power was closer to 250%.
You could buy five times more things of value if you had gold back from 20 to 1933.
Kevin, it's a compelling case for gold in the context of a deflation. And I'm afraid what people have forgotten, it is a standout amongst the commodities. It shares that moniker, but only loosely, because the longer tradition of gold has been valued as a currency. I suppose it reminds me, Kevin, of our interview with Harold James, where he suggested that we look at history from a different perspective and look for a deeper history. And maybe that's just looking further back in time or looking at nuances within history that are often neglected. And this would certainly be one, at least in terms of contemporary or modern history, that is overlooked. It is money far more than it is a commodity.
David, something that your dad has brought to the table so many times. He talks about inflation and deflation coexisting at the same time. I know something that drives you absolutely berserk is when people who manage money talk in absolutes or hyperbole. You know, they say, well, I'm an inflationist, and this is why I do what I do. Or, I'm a deflationist, this is why I do what I do. But there is, in a crisis, a mix of things falling in price and rising in price. And really, the main goal at that point is just to retain value somehow, some way, and not be shaken out of the tree.
Kevin, the weakness in most investors' minds is that they want certainty and they want clarity, and they're never going to get it. There's too many things happening. There's too much complexity to really even aspire to having that, but it's what people want. They want an understanding. They want security in the decisions that they're making. So it is easier to think in terms of hyperbole, and either or. It's either inflation or deflation.
Right.
It's very complex and almost impossible for most investors to see that both can coexist. Just as you can have growth in a business cycle and a decline in certain sectors at the same time. Investing is always nuanced. It's always nuanced. And what we find, Kevin, is that that's exactly what we have today. We have too much debt. In certain areas, we're going to see it unwind. You're going to see the consequences of that show up in certain sectors of the economy. And there will be standouts. There will be standouts. What will those standouts be? Well, on a singular note, I think gold is one of those. But it's not enough to say deflation, all things bad but cash.
Right.
Inflation, all things bad but gold. Unfortunately, life just isn't that easy, and anyone striving for that kind of simplicity in investing hasn't been around long enough.
Well, David, and you've talked about the triangle so many times, but there are traps in all three sides of the triangles. You know, the banker's trap is just to be completely in cash, right? Let's take the opposite side, the gold bug's trap. 100% in gold, and then, of course, Wall Street's trap is
what? 100% in equities.
Okay, but if you balance things out, you basically covered your bases without having to take a side.
Well, and there is this idea that you have to maximize exposures. What you really should be trying to do as a professional is identify what exactly is going on and load the boat 100% in that direction. So the equity guys on Wall Street would say, no, we've identified what the trend is and we're 100% in equities. And the banker will identify that same trend, but from his own unique vantage point, self-interested vantage point, mind you, as will the gold broker or as will the gold bug. And the gold bug will say 100% or nothing. Don't you see? We know this is the end of the world as we know it. If only it was that simple.
Right.
If only it was that simple.
If only it was the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah. Well, and if you know that, then you can make certain decisions
right,
with a greater degree of certitude and know that you will be proven right. That's the problem, Kevin, is history, as nuanced as history is, so is living history in the day-to-day. It's not going to be what you expect it to be 100%. Our goal as a company is try to eliminate as many things as we can that are low probability events and excel those things to the forefront of our minds that are higher probability events. That doesn't mean that there's certitude or certainty with any of these things, which is one of the reasons why I do like the perspective triangle. It gives you a balanced approach. It's not nuanced enough for any professional to say, there's the end-all and be-all of my investment asset allocation. But you know what it is? It is a reminder every day for every investor that you don't know everything, and unless you know everything, you can't place 100% or 100% of your eggs in one basket.
Well, and just a reminder to the new listener, I mean, the investment triangle is just a simple back-of-the-napkin concept where you can put on the right side of the triangle your liquidity, on the base of the triangle your insurance, which is not an insurance company, but it's actually physically held precious metals, and then the left side of the triangle, of course, is your growth mandate, which can be Wall Street, it can be bonds, it can be a number of things, but when you have those three mandates in place, in relative thirds, you don't have to make sure it's complete thirds, but it does give a balance that we've seen through the decades just really perform.
I mean, we've talked about this maybe a year ago, the difference between an equilateral and an isosceles triangle. You may, as a professional, adjust one side or the other to favor a certain thematic, but again, what I like about this simple picture in your mind is that it reminds you every day to be humble as you're approaching the investment markets, because if you don't adopt an humble mindset, that is what the market will do to you. It will force you to accept an humble mindset because you didn't have enough information going in.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.